Blog Talk Radio.
Hello?
Looks like we had a little bit of a glitch here. Our microphone or something on their end wasn't working. This is Patty Holstrand and this is KWOD Radio. And we're on live today with Sharon Skinner. But before we get to Sharon, it looks like she might be on the line, is we want to go over a couple of shout-outs. And one shout out is to a young man named Christopher who's trying to get from Malaysia to Finland. I know it seems interesting, but he is trying to get to Finland to work. So every little bit helps. He needs his visa. He, you know, all those things that you need in order to get from one location to another. And believe it or not, they have residence permits and all sorts of things. So, you know, he needs his passport and all those incidentals that he needs to be able to get to a different country to work. So, please, every little bit helps. And I'm going to put that information. He has his crowdfunding on youcaring.com. That's youcaring.com, not one that's known as well as others. And the project is called To Finland or Bust. To Finland or Bust. I know it's fun. So definitely take a look at that one. And also another shout out to a brand new one. Well, actually, you know what? I'll talk about that one later because it has to do with a little bit about Sharon and some things that she's into. So we are definitely going to be live here. But we want to do an intro here. Sharon, she is an award-winning author, so we're very excited to have her on board. She's also from Arizona here. Well, she's originally, not originally from Arizona, but she's definitely here now. And she received a BA in English from Prescott College, which I, you know, that's interesting that she'd be up north here. Of course, Prescott is part of Arizona. And yes, they had trees there. And speaking of trees, it looks like we've got a dust storm going on outside and looks like it's threatening to rain. So we can only hope. I know. Rain in the desert was a concept. From 1996 to 2004, Sharon has served as executive editor for Anthology Magazine, a small press literary magazine published in Mesa, which of course is where we are stationed right now. Her work has appeared in a number of periodicals, including Greens Magazine, New Moon Rising, The Mesa Legends. Well, we'll have to talk about that one for sure. Mosaic Minds and the Barnes & Noble Metaverse Poetry Anthology. She had her roots in poetry, and she expanded into fiction. And she's got a couple of books that we're definitely going to be talking about today. But what's interesting about her is that she's got such a diverse life experiences. And if you read her information on right underneath the show, you scroll down, you've got like her whole bio there. And she moved to Arizona in 1981 after a 4-year stint of the U.S. Navy, where she learned electronics and traveled halfway around the world on the USS Jason, a repair ship and first naval vessel, to take a contingency of women on a full 6-month Westpac cruise. So we definitely find her interesting, and we know you will too. Sharon.
Hi, Patty. How are you?
Good. It's an odd one outside, so, you know, it's got this dust storm coming in. Did you see that?
Yeah, it's that time of the year. It's been threatening for quite a while today over here in this part of the valley. So we expect to see hopefully some wet stuff.
Yeah, because, you know, we don't like to have sand with, you know, and dust without some kind of wet stuff.
Yeah, knock it back down so we can breathe again.
I know it. Got to dump some water so that way, you know, it clears out the air. It would be nice. And that happens so yeah, this doesn't happen very often here, so we definitely like it when it happens. Did you hear a little bit of what I said about your great diverse life experiences?
Mm-hmm. I was listening.
And, you know, I didn't even get into your grant writing.
Yeah, I, you know, I've had kind of a zigzaggy path through life for my career. Interestingly enough, through it all, I've always written. It's one of the things that I've always done is I've always been a writer. I started in grade school, and I never really have quit. You know, I went through a phase where it was short stories in grade school, and then I moved into poetry. Of course, when I was a teenager, I got a lot of angst out in my poetry, as we all do. And as I got older, my poetry got a lot more focused, and I got into woven poetry, patterns, poetry that works in patterns, you know, and explored a lot of that. And then I was taking a creative writing class at one point many, many moons ago. And one of the things that we were asked to do was to write the first chapter or two of a novel as part of this creative writing class. And I sat down and drafted the entire novel. And in just a few weeks. And it was just so thrilling to me. And then I realized that at that point that what I had to say needed a bigger format, you know, to be, for me to really tell my stories. And that's when I started novel writing.
Wow. See, usually people get started with short stories and then they work up.
Well, so I did. I mean, I did some short stories when I was younger. And I've written some short stories since I've been doing the novel writing. But, you know, short stories are not easy. You know, we think shorter writing as being easy, but short stories are not necessarily any easier than novels. They're challenging to do well, and in their own way.
Yes, indeed, because we have to tell those. It has to make sense, but with less
right.
words.
And you want to have this full arc. You want to really explore some sort of emotion or, you know, some sort of character in a much shorter space. And having something that comes out really satisfying for the reader, I think, can often be a bigger challenge to do it in the short form in some ways. Especially when, with me, I have so many layers that I want to explore in my writing.
And that is a good point. That's something that, again, like you said, a lot of people don't realize how hard that particular, you know, job is. And it is kind of daunting if you can, you know, they think, well, you know, novels are daunting. Well, yes, it is. But on the other hand, if you try to do a successful short story, you know, you see how how hard it is compared to something that's longer and you have more room, you know, breathing room.
Right. They're both challenging in their own ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, you really have to stick to it with the novel. And you have to be able to have enough story and enough character arc and enough of interest to keep the reader engaged throughout. But with a short story, go ahead.
I was going to ask you, what was your first story then that you started in your creative writing class?
The first book, the first novel?
Yeah.
The Nellig Stones, which is the one that's just now come out. It's just been published this year, and it came out in March. The first draft of that was written in 1985? No, let's see. 19... would have been 95.
Wow.
No, 85. 1985. Would have been the first draft of that in 1985. And it wasn't very good, I will admit. It was very first draft. It was very early writing for me. I had a lot to learn. But I got so excited when I was writing it that I actually would get up and pace the room. I would have to get up and walk and pace the room and get some of that energy out before I could sit back down and finish writing the more exciting and dramatic scenes. And I loved it so much. And it just sort of poured out of me so rapidly and so easily that, I thought, oh, my gosh, this is what I really want to do. This is the stage upon which I want to showcase my stories, this larger format, this novel format. Of course, it took me a lot of years to learn how to do it really well and how to edit myself to a point where it's publishable, but I'm still excited about the writing. Very often, I have a novel in draft right now that I'm very excited about. I love the voice. I love spending time with the character. And I think that that's kind of key. If you don't love spending time with your characters in a novel, the reader won't either. And you need to spend a lot of time with them, more time than a reader will, because it takes a lot more hours to write it and revision it and make sure that it's an engaging story than it does to sit down and read it.
Absolutely. So it took you quite a while to not only learn the craft then, but you had to pick that story back up and that part, start rewriting it. And is that reason why you didn't get back to it right away, or is it that a different story kind of decided to, or the character started to get in your way?
Well, I think it was a combination of things. I actually... at that time was working on my AA, so my associate's degree. And then I went on to finish my BA, and then I actually got my master's in creative writing from Prescott up north, but it was a distance learning program. And in between drafting that first novel and the next one, I did write some short stories. I wrote a lot of poetry. I was in the slam scene, so I did a lot of spoken word, and I was very focused on that, along with having a job. I was working full-time, had a couple of kids to raise, and I was going to school. So the novel kind of got put away until I was working on my master's in creative writing, and at that time, one of the things that I ended up doing is I had a seed for another novel, but I had sort of begun to write shortly before I started my master's work. And during the master's work, I ended up doing an 18-month program for my master's. And during that time, I actually completed the second novel, which actually turned out to be my first published novel, The Healer's Legacy, and used it as part of my thesis for my creative writing. So my thesis was 70-something pages long, and it was accompanied by a 200-page novel, basically. And the thesis was based on the premise that fantasy literature works as resistant texts to social norming. So my concept behind that is that, we get a lot of messaging, especially since our social norming tends to still be very patriarchal. Women still don't have the equality that that I think that as a humanist, which is what I am, I would like to see us have. We're not on an equal footing in many ways. And we get this messaging through marketing and sales and through a lot of other places that very much skews our own self-image as women, as young girls. And fantasy and all sorts of other fiction, science fiction, things like that, not only can explore our environment and our social situation from enough of a distance to help us to see these things a little more clearly, but also it gives us an opportunity to provide a place where women can be strong, they can be heroes without being superwomen, they can be, you know, they can be human and be okay and not be perfect and yet be heroes in their own stories. And to me, this creates a resistant text that can push back against that social norming that we're getting with all this marketing and all these things that we're being barraged with that are telling us a different story about who we are. And therefore, it pushes back against that and gives us a platform from which to understand ourselves and to view ourselves in a better light as young girls and as women. And so that was the idea behind writing The Healer's Legacy in a way that showed that it was okay to be different. It was okay to be a strong woman, even in a social setting that didn't promote that.
Well,
and hopefully
awesome.
That doesn't put anybody off from reading the book, because it's also a really good story.
Well, again, it's fantasy. It's a great story. It's just, you know, and honestly, there's a lot of books, especially in fantasy, that have these kind of, you know, either political or sociological ideas behind it. And it's just perfectly fine for that to happen.
Right.
Yeah. You know, even Shakespeare had his own political agendas.
Right. And that's why when I talk about the layering that I put into my work, you can read it just as a story, and people have. They've just read it as a story. Oh, a nice book, you know. Oh, I like this story, or I like this character. But you can read it on a deeper level, and in fact, multiple levels in the story, and get a lot more out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends on the reader and how deeply they read.
Yes, I find that sometimes they read so fast that they're just getting like the superficial part of the story and not really investing as much. And you know, after all the months and years that we spend on their books, if they can get it done that fast, it's like, wow, you know, wish you guys could spend a little more time with it.
Yes, but on the other hand, you know, people enjoy things and read in their own ways, and any kind of art. You know, it's that whole joke about when you hang the picture on the wall and someone says it's upside down. You know, what you see in the art, and to me, writing is, you know, very much an art form for me of expression. But I also know that the reader is going to view through their own lens what they're reading. They're going to have their own experiences that they bring to it. Just as you do when you're seeing a picture on the wall, you'll interpret it based on your own life experiences and your own knowledge. And so I learned to be a very deep reader early on because of my fascination with English literature and things like that. And I've had some great, great instructors throughout my education to help me to learn to be a deeper reader. But sometimes people just want to read for the enjoyment of it, and there's nothing wrong with that either.
Definitely. You know, we were talking also about all your other life experiences, and I thought it was fascinating, all the different places that you have written stories at, the different places. And one of them kind of stood out to me, the Mesa Legend, which I happen to know is the newspaper for the Mesa Community College.
Yeah, yes, it is. I went to Mesa Community College. I got a great education there. I firmly believe that community college system is, this one especially, it's a great system. And I actually was for a while a freelance writer for The Legend, and then for a little while I was considered staff. And I did a lot of op-ed pieces and things like that, so human interest stories, that kind of thing. I did one year for Valentine's Day that talked about safe sex, as a matter of fact. So that was interesting. So I had some very interesting assignments while I was there, and I really enjoyed writing for The Legend.
Journalism writing is definitely different than creative writing.
Absolutely, it is. And I know that it's also different than technical writing, which is
yes.
what I do my day job. So as my day job, I write grant proposals, and that's basically a form of technical writing. And also when I was doing the biomedical field service engineering, which is what I did when I first got out of the Navy. So I worked in the hospitals and laboratories installing and maintaining their laboratory equipment. I actually did some technical writing there. I wrote some manuals and some maintenance processes and things like that. So when I say I've always been a writer, that's what I'm talking about. I write across the gamut of the forms and styles of writing that you can explore.
Yeah, apparently so. And, you know, not everybody can do, you can write in so many different varieties of styles. So that's definitely something that you're gifted at.
Well, thank you. I think it has to do with my, I'm a bit of a dichotomous individual, and so my left brain and my right brain do tend to war against one another, or they did when I was younger, and I think I've tried to teach them that they can live in harmony if they just let one, if I can spend some time left brain and then I can spend some time right brain, you know, everything tends to balance out. I don't get too stuck and I don't end up with that competing stuff.
Well, I want to let everybody know now, we do have some weather, pretty bad weather coming in here, so if by chance, I know some other areas of town earlier this week had suddenly lost their electricity. If that happens, then, you know, we'll just dodge and weave and see if we can get back up pretty quickly. Otherwise, you know, if you're out of electricity because everything shut down, there's not much you can do. I'm just warning you ahead of time. Now, also, I want to let everybody know that I don't have to have Sharon all by myself. So I know that you've got a few people sitting there in chat. If you guys have questions and you don't want to call in, you can go ahead and write your questions or comments under the chat area, which is just below the show. So you write that in there, and I will ask the question or, you know, relay the comment to Sharon. Also, the call-in number is 714-242-5145, 242-5145. I'm going to get back down to something that, you know, I was talking about how diverse your life experience have been. You were talking about being in the U.S. Navy, and then also you talked about being a DJ. You are just so diverse, woman. I don't know what to do with you.
Well, it's interesting because what happened was I was, before I went into the Navy, I had actually gotten gotten a job at a radio station. I was actually doing sales and marketing for a radio station, you know, where you go out and you talk to businesses and you say, hey, we want to, you know, do a live broadcast from your roller rink or whatever it is. And meanwhile, one of the DJs heard my voice and asked if I would do some commercials. So I actually got paid quite well for these commercials because for the few minutes that it took to record them, I got more money than what I was making in commission doing the, you know, setting up these businesses. But the fun thing was that because I have this, I tend to have a deeper voice for a woman, they were having me do things like waterbed commercials and those kinds of things.
Yeah.
And I actually had people who would actually call them up and request to have me come on at my voice. For their advertising. So that was a lot of fun. Then when I went into the Navy, when I was on the USS Jason, We spent 2.5 months stationed at Diego Garcia, which is called the, it's actually known as the Footprint of American Freedom. It's a small island in the middle of the Indian Ocean that the United States leases from the British and uses it as a military base to get us, you know, closer to the Middle East and places like that. Well, I happened, this is going to date me, because I was in the Navy during the Iran hostage situation.
Oh, wow.
So we were there for 2.5 months, and my ship was an AR-8, which is a repair ship. So we could basically repair any other ship from the waterline up and some things below the waterline. We had our own divers and everything. So we spent 2.5 months at Diego Garcia actually doing repairs and maintenance for a lot of the ships that were there because of the Iran hostage situation. And so we would have carriers there, and we had nuclear subs there, and, you know, we had other ships that would come to us and ask us to repair their electronics, you know, or what have you. Well, 2.5 months is a long time to be sitting at sea, and there was no pier at that time. There is now, but there was no pier at the island, so you would have to take the small boat in to and from the ship to go to shore. And while I was ashore one day, I happened to be talking to this fellow who ran the radio station there, the Armed Forces radio station at Diego Garcia, and we got to talking about my experience, and he said, well, how would you like to do your own show? So I said, sure. So for the last couple of months that I was there, I was the Saturday morning FM rock jock on Armed Forces radio in the Indian Ocean, and I was the first female voice to be carried on those particular sound waves out there.
Wow.
It was fun, too.
Yeah. And you probably got a lot of fans at that time.
I did. I had a lot of, it was an early morning show. It started fairly early in the morning on a Saturday, and surprisingly, there were quite a few call-ins for requests.
Well, so you show people through their errands, yeah.
Well, so there were 48 women on my ship. There were 928, a crew of 928, 48 of us were women. The island had a contingency of, I want to say it was 1,100, and it was mostly Seabees. And then we had all those other ships that would come in and be there for repairs and stuff. So, you know, they didn't hear a lot of female voices out there. So, yeah, I had a fairly big fan base.
Well, you know, I knew there was a story there. And it's great to find out more about that. I read it, it says, okay, we got to talk about this, because I could just tell there was a great story in there. And it was. That's awesome that you two be, you know, on the Orange radio station. That is a lot. And you've gotten around to other countries. Any other place other than the Indian Ocean area, or is that, you know, pretty much where were?
Well, no, we did a 6-month cruise. So and we were on the first ship that took women on a full 6-month Westpac. There was one ship prior to us that went out for a few weeks with women aboard and then came back. And we were the first ship that actually took women on board. We lived there. It was our home, and we went on a full 6-month Westpac, but we lived on the ship year round. So
we
went from San Diego. We were stationed out of San Diego, and we went from there to Hawaii, and from there to the Philippines. So got to see the Philippines. From there, we went to Japan. Spent a month in Japan. Japan was amazing. Mostly, I ate because the food was marvelous. But I also got to go and see a lot of really interesting things, kabuki theater, things like that. And then from there, we went to the Indian Ocean and the Indian Ocean and the Indian Ocean and spent that 2.5 months at Diego Garcia. And then we went to Australia, and we were in Australia for, I want to say, 6 or 7 days, right around a week. So that was pretty exciting. And, you know, so I got to pet a kangaroo, things like that. And then we came back to Hawaii and came back to San Diego. And then most of the shipmates got off the ship. And then we went back to, because we were reassigned, that ship was reassigned to become the island hopper for the Hawaiian Islands. And I rode the ship back to Hawaii and only had 9 days left in the Navy by the time, you know, we got back there. And so I spent a lot of time hanging out on the beach before they flew me home. It was quite fun.
Yeah. Now, I know that Ray Bradbury often said that your experience, life experiences always seem to come out in your story. And you have to let them ferment and, you know, come out in their own accord. Do you find that there's some things that you've done in your past that seem to come out in your story?
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. I think there are a couple of things that go on. And, you know, one is that you write from life experience. You write from those things that you've either directly or indirectly experienced in your growth as a person. You write about the relationships that you've had. I think it just automatically comes out on paper. There's not a lot you could do to stop it, I don't think, as a writer. The other thing, too, is that I think it's important to feed the hopper. And what I mean by that is that I try to stuff as many – I'm a voracious reader. So I'm always looking at information. I'm always reading mythology. I'm reading other books. In fact, I just reread some Bradbury recently because I wanted that poetic, amazing language of Bradbury to start to seep back out through me. So I think that when I say feed the hopper, it's I want to add all those things into my brain that I hope will somehow find its way out into my stories. And I don't mean that I'm going to copy Bradbury's language, but that his amazing use of language will filtrate through me and come out in my own style, things like that.
Right.
So I'm always reading, and I read a lot of fiction, nonfiction, mythology, poetry, science fiction, fantasy, kids' books, adult books, just a very voracious reader. So I'm always reading or listening to a book on tape and things like that. I'll watch television to try and get the feel of dialogue and to watch how characters interact, things like that. And the fortunate thing is that we have so much media that surrounds us that it's easy to do that. The unfortunate thing is that it can be time-consuming.
Yeah.
So, you know, but I think that it's important to always feed the hopper.
I definitely agree. And she's not just talking about education. She's talking about, you know, doing things in your life and also reading in order to continue the cycle. And hey, it's so great to hear that you are reading some Ray Bradbury. That's who I fell in love with first. So
yeah, I just read, I just finished From the Dust Returned, and it's just he was writing magical realism before there was a name for magical realism.
yeah, and he also said that he's not a science fiction writer. Says he always said that he wrote stories about people.
Right. People and relationships.
Yes. And he was very much into that, no matter what the age is. And he really really loved exploring the young boys.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know.
Well, I think that he revisited his own youth often and well for a lot of his writing. And I think that happens for me, too. I think that especially since I focus on young adults and middle grade novels for the most part, those are the places where my voice seems to really be true, where those are my strengths. I understand those characters and those relationships really well, and those are the stories that I really want to tell. So my protagonists tend to be a little younger. I will say The Healer's Legacy was a lovely surprise for me because I had written it as a young adult novel, but it has a huge, broad readership. I have readers from ages 12 all the way to 81 reading this book, men and women, who are coming back and saying how much they like the book, how much they enjoyed reading it, how much they like the characters. So that's been a really great and exciting thing for me, because you just don't know when you write if you are going to hit that crossover audience when you're writing YA. And I think it's more common than it used to be that adults are reading the young adult novels, but mm-hmm. you just never know.
And that's true. Some people just, you know, they focus on the science fiction and that's all they want to read. But I think that that's thinning out because there's not so much of it right now. And so I think a lot more younger people are getting into the fantasy stories.
And fantasy is starting to really take off again, which it wasn't for a while. So.
Yeah, definitely. It's everything. It's got an ebb and flow.
Right.
You know, we have more mainstream sometimes, and then we've got more genre.
I think
really picked up.
Yeah, genre's picked up. Urban fantasy is huge, you know, all the mm-hmm. vampires, whether they sparkle or not, really big right now. So a lot of urban fantasy, too, you see a lot of that. Steampunk is really coming to the fore in both science fiction and fantasy, so that's interesting to watch that. I'm a fan of steampunk, so it's interesting to watch how it comes to the fore. It used to be more obscure and cultish, and now it's really, you know, in not just in literature, you know, in general, but, you know, now more and more people are becoming exposed to the genre. There's more film out there. There's music out there. It's really interesting to watch that. It's really fun.
Yeah, the costumes are becoming more mainstream too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when that starts getting more mainstream, then we get a lot more people interested in that in the time period. You know, the Victorian era.
Right.
It's a cool time. Because of the fact that more industrialization, more gadgets, people came up with ideas, they started creating, creating things. So that was a good, cool time period because of that. A lot more.
Right, and then to have it reimagined, even kind of amplified, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, and I know that you had just put out a story or a book based on steampunk. You want to tell us about that one?
Yeah, the first in a line of stories, it's the Chronicles of Devara Tinker. I co-wrote it with Bob Nelson. And it's the story of this woman, and again, a very strong female character who doesn't really quite fit into the Victorian pattern of a sophisticated lady. But she can kind of fit in where she needs to. But she goes on these adventures, and she creates and builds these gadgets and makes these, bulletproof outfits and things like that for people. And she and her partner, Jonathan, go on all of these adventures, and they have a really interesting relationship. And she kind of takes a lot of things in stride, and she's always kind of getting them into the fray of things where they kind of have to battle their way out. And there's a little bit of humor involved in that that's a lot of fun to do, especially in the give and take between those two characters. So we are working on the second of those. The first one is called the first one is the Paris story, and then we are working on the second story right now. And that's a fun process because we'll come up with an idea, and then we'll take turns writing on it. So I'm waiting to get it back right now because Bob's doing his work on it. So,
yeah, you guys are just being voracious lately. You got the new one, and then now you're working on the second one.
Mm-hmm. So. Yep.
Keep him busy. So, what are you exactly writing about now? What are you working on?
I'm working on a couple of things. I always have things in the pipeline. So I mentioned earlier that I have an urban fantasy that is, I just finished drafting, and it is sitting in the pipeline in what I call the refrigerator. So it's in the chiller. because I need to have time away before I can come in and figure out where all the plot holes are and things like that when I go to do my second draft. While that's sitting in the chiller, I am actually just finished final revisions on the next middle grade book that's coming out after the first of the year. It's a ghost story. It's called Mirabella and the Faded Phantom. And it's about a young girl who's dealing with the loss of her father. And she ends up moving into a house that is haunted by a ghost that's forgotten why it's there. And in her efforts to help this ghost remember who it is, it actually helps her to come to terms with her own loss. And so that one's coming out. And I'm really, really excited because I just got permission. There's a quote in there from Peter S. Eagle's A Fine and Private Place that I really wanted to include in the book as part of the story. And so Mirabella is reading that book, and there's a place where she wants to know what it means, and so she's asking the ghost. And so I've used a quote, and I actually just got permission from Peter S. Beagle to go ahead and use that quote, and he sent me the front matter for the book and everything on how to credit it. So I'm really excited about that because I'm a huge, huge fan, and I had this huge fangirl moment where I was afraid to ask. I've heard he's a really nice guy, and yet I was really afraid to ask because what if he said no, you know? And I got a little panicked about it, and then it dawned on me one day that, well, if he said no, I could rewrite that scene. So, because I'm the writer, I could do that. But I was so excited. I sent him a message, and he responded very quickly within a day or two. And so there will be a quote in that book from Peter Beagle, and I'm excited about that. So that's coming out. It still needs to be, you know, put into format and then proofed and those things, but there is an artist working on the cover and everything. So that's exciting. So that one's in the pipeline. The next one's in draft, sitting in the chiller, and now I'm drafting the sequel to The Healer's Legacy, and I've got about 27,000 words written on that right now.
So I'm sure everybody's excited about that one, yes.
I am getting a lot of requests for that, so no pressure.
Yeah, exactly. Fans do that. They get so excited about your work that they start pushing you to get your second and third book out there.
Right. I want to do it right, and I want to give them something worth having, and I don't want to let them down. So I am working on it. It's about a third of the way drafted. But again, once it's drafted, it'll have to go into the chiller. So hopefully that'll be – my goal is to have it drafted before the end of this year so that I can be working on the revisions after the first of the year while I'm marketing Mirabella and the Faded Phantom.
There you go. How long do you keep your books in the chiller?
Depends on what else I've got going on. I don't have a set time period. I just need at least 6 to 8 weeks to get away from it, get my brain doing something else so that when I go back, I get to read it with fresh eyes and a little bit of a fresh brain. And then I can see where all the saggy spots are and things like that. I do use a number of tools for revisioning. And I say revisioning rather than rewriting because sometimes you are revisioning the story or the character arc and things like that. So you're really, really looking at what is it you really want to say. I took a course from Darcy Patterson. She does a great, great retreat and some great courses on revisioning. She also has a website where she shares information, and she's got some workbooks out on how to revise and revision and plot and things like that. So that's Darcy Patterson, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N. I really, really like what she has, the tools that she provides. And then I've also used some other things like the Plot Whisperer, Martha Alderson, and things like that as part of the tools in my toolbox.
That's important to have. There you go. You have to have lots of those.
Yep, it's important, and it's important to keep honing your craft, honing your craft. I'm always trying to learn new things. In fact, every year I go to the writing conference for, it's the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators International Writing Summer Writing Conference that I go to every year in L.A. I go out there for a week and they do a lot of workshops. They have authors there, they have editors, they have publishers, they have agents. They're all, you know, workshopping and talking about the craft, and you just get immersed in it, and that's pretty exciting. And then I actually help to facilitate the local annual conference that takes place here in Arizona. So it's the Society of Children's Writers and Illustrators Arizona Conference. And so I help to facilitate that along with other workshops. So we bring in different authors and industry experts. And so I'm constantly learning, constantly.
Mm-hmm. I wrote down, just for those who are listening, and I know you're there because I can see you in the dark, it's DarcyPattison.com is on there. I put down the chat so that way you guys can just click and go onto, you know, to the website that she was just talking about. Also, the books that we were discussing is also the information on where to find them on Brick Cave Media, their website. So definitely click on there. Those are probably got to copy and paste into the... They're a bit long, apparently, to automatically go into link format. But definitely click on, you know, copy and paste them and find out more about these specific books. It's exciting that you have gone into, you know, a lot of different conferences and also writers' workshops. Do you suggest that highly for others, especially when they're getting started?
Oh, especially when you're getting started. For one thing, it's important to be learning everything you can about your craft. It's also important to network with other people so that you can find those people who are either going to be the people who work in your critique group or the people who you trust to be your feedback, your beta readers, or your... I have a person who is a very close friend, and we edit each other's work. So we push back on each other quite a bit. To make sure that the questions are answered and that the holes are filled and that the writing is the strongest that it can be. And it's very easy to think that you've covered all those bases when you're the writer. It's also easy to think you said what you thought you said when you wrote it, when you read it, which is why it's so important to have beta readers and other people read it, because you may know what you meant by that, but, you know, when somebody else reads it, they may think, well, that doesn't look physically possible to me. I don't know what that person is supposed to be doing. You know, that character is all twisted around in a circle. I don't know. Or it's awkward. I don't get it. Or, you know, that sort of thing. So I think it's really important. It's also really important for me even now to continually hone my craft. Writing is one of those things that I don't think you ever get perfect at. You don't reach a pinnacle at. You can always, I think, strive for better in your writing. So I think that it's important to continuously hone the craft.
But it's also one of the jobs that you can do and you never have to retire from.
Right. Well, the great thing for me, you know, I used to have people years ago who would tell me, I don't understand it. You can't, how do you write all day and then go home and write? You know, you're crazy and I don't understand it. But again, left brain, right brain. So if I'm writing technical stuff during the day and I go home at night, I put my fiction hat on and it's a whole other world for me. And it's a world I love to be in. So, and especially if you love your characters or if you love to hate on your characters. I had someone recently tell me how much they hated one of the antagonists in The Healer's Legacy, and I just did the happy dance because not only, number one, was that the intention, but number two is if you hate her, she's real enough. You can think that she's a person that you dislike. So I did my job here.
You did your job.
Yeah.
they have emotional impact from that character.
Right. And really, that's right. And that's the whole idea for me. I've always believed that I've always wanted to reach readers. I've always wanted to have my work published, not just to be a published author, but because for me, it's important. I don't think it makes sense to have a transmitter without a receiver. And that goes back to my Navy days of working as an electronics technician. That's what I worked on, with antennas and radios and things like that. But I think it's important to have a receiver for every transmitter. And for me, that means I need readers. I really want my work to touch people, to move people, to have them engage and have an emotional experience. I think one of the biggest compliments that I've had is that someone on Facebook posted a little thing that said, you know that feeling when you've just finished the book you were reading and you look up and you look around and you see that everybody else has gone on with their life and has not just had a traumatic emotional experience like you've had? That's what I just had with this book. And she was talking about my book, and that's just exciting for me.
Yes, definitely.
That's what I aim for. That's the goal.
Definitely, and that's exciting. I find that somebody says, I couldn't put it down. I had to go to the bathroom with me.
Yes, the people who say, yeah, or the people who say, you got me in trouble because I couldn't put your book down and I went to work late.
You're going, I got my job.
Exactly. Listen to those moments.
You say, oh, I'm sorry. But inside you're going, you're doing a happy dance.
I don't think I apologized for that one. I just did the happy dance. And I said, I'm so glad you like it. And I'm sorry you were late for work. But I'm so glad you like it.
Yeah.
So I guess I did apologize a little bit. Not a lot. Yeah.
I'm going to go back and talk about your poetry. Okay.
Okay.
You have a book out called In Case You Didn't Hear Me the First Time, which I thought was an interesting name for a poetry book. And I know that you were into, slamming, and I have a few people who would like to understand better what that is. I figure you might be able to enlighten them.
Okay, well, I was on the slam circuit for a while, and what that basically is it's performance poetry. But it's done in a way that engages the audience, that's specifically designed to engage the audience by having audience members as judges to judge the performance and the content of the poetry in an Olympic-style numbering system, so from 1 to 10. And you have 5 judges in the audience, and the high and low scores are thrown out, and the 3 middle scores are added together, and that's your score for that round. Slam's typically done in 3 rounds, for what they call a bout. And so each poet would get 3 minutes per round in 3 rounds. And at the end of the night, whoever has the highest points wins. And as a matter of fact, this Friday night is the Copper State Poetry Slam, the Phoenix Arts Center, and I'm actually hosting the second bout at 8:45 on Friday night. So
see how that worked out?
Friday night. Yeah. See how that worked in there? Friday night and Saturday night, they're doing that. So I was doing the slam circuit for a while, so I kind of got into this style of delivering my poetry in a performance manner. And since I did a lot of theater when I was younger, and in fact, when I first went to college, I was a drama major. I started as a drama major with an English minor when I was first going to college. And so I have a little bit of a background. I did a lot of community theater when I was younger. So I have a little bit of background for that, which is nice. I can project and I can perform. So that was a lot of fun. But so what you'll see in that book is some of the poems in that book, one of the reasons that it's titled what it is some of those poems were poems that I performed on that poetry circuit when I was doing the slam and the performance poetry. So some of those poems were written specifically for that time. And so that was kind of the idea behind the title. Now, there are some brand new things in the book as well, and some short stories and some essays. There's even a couple of things in there about my time in the military. There's one about Diego Garcia. So it talks about the island from the perspective of being a young person in the Navy out in the middle of nowhere in this pristine environment. So there's a lot of that going on in there. And then the reason for the pictures on the front, the VLA, is the whole idea of the transmitters and receivers and the listening. Those, you know, the very large array in New Mexico is designed specifically to listen to sounds from outer space. And
Right.
So that was kind of the idea behind the title and then the picture on the cover. I actually took that picture, which is kind of fun. So.
For those who want to know more about the Poetry Slam, I have included the link down in the chat area. It's clickable, so you click on it, and it'll tell you more about what's going on this weekend and where to get tickets and what you possibility of being seen. And it'd be a lot of fun. So I know I'm going out in order to be able to do some speaking and be able to witness the slammers. So it should be fun.
Yeah, it'll be fun. It's teams, so it'll be really fun, and we may get to see some really good team pieces. Those are really exciting when they do group pieces.
Yeah, I saw them last year, and I was at the Poetry Slam last year when it was in Casa Grande. So definitely interesting. And that was my first experience of Poetry Slam. And then I saw them.
It's a lot of fun, isn't it?
Yeah. And I saw them saw some Poetry Slam for the first time at Phoenix Comic Con. And I was absolutely amazed when I walked into this huge, you know, auditorium. And it was full of people enjoying Poetry Slam. And I'm going like, whoa, you mean people were actually into poetry?
Exactly.
But it's performance, you know, it's performance poetry, and you've got people who are passionate about what they're writing. And
yeah,
that's
it's a little different than what you're used to hearing, where people get up and flat read, like academians tend to read their poems very flat because they want you to concentrate on the content, whereas slam, it's 50% focused on content, and the other 50% is all about the performance.
So they get you excited when you start watching them, because that's exactly what kind of, you know, they want you to get excited about what they're saying. So
exactly.
It's you guys got to try it out, because it's definitely something to see. And of course you have fun. It's about, I would say it's even better than a comedy club, because more than likely they won't make fun of you out in the audience.
You don't get heckled the same way,
There you go. Now, what did your family think about your writing? How does that interaction go with you?
They're very supportive. You know, the girls are grown now, so they're out of the house. But I'll be honest with you, when they were still here at home, we had a system which was much like the on-air system for a radio station. I had a big piece of red paper that said, working. And when I would go into my office to work, I would tape that above the door. And they learned very quickly that this was not the time to bother me, that I was going in there. And I didn't ignore them. I would come out and cook dinners and things like that. But for the hour or 2 hours where I needed to focus on whatever my writing or my schoolwork or whatever, I would drop this little paper down, this red sheet of paper. And they knew during this time not to ask for a pencil to be sharpened or, you know, a drink of water or anything. All that stuff needed to be taken care of before I went in or after I came out, unless it was an emergency. And they learned very early, very young, that was the process. And they were really good about it. And, in fact, they were my beta readers for Healers and Frenelic Stones.
Wow.
Because, you know, I mean, and I got honest feedback from them, which was really nice, you know. A little hard to take sometimes from your teenage daughters, but at the same time, it was good feedback. So, you know, and that's what I asked for, so you can't really complain.
No, that's definitely true, and it's great that they are involved. So that's, you know, having written the fantasy world, there's obviously not a whole lot of questionable material in there, so it probably helps not to have any of that in there.
Well, you know, the girls have been exposed to a lot of language and ideas and concepts from an early age because slam poetry, we've always taken them to the slams and things like that, and even when they were younger, they learned how to get on the microphone themselves, how to host about, how to be, to public speak, which was really important. Harmony did such a great job with it that when she got into high school, she ended up joining the debate team, and her school won regionals every year that she was on that team. So they won state and regionals. So that's pretty cool. And, you know, they learned how to have a presence in front of the room. But what else it did for them is it exposed them to a diversity of people and ideas that young kids don't necessarily get exposed to. Now, so sometimes the language, you know, was, I would cringe a little.
Awful.
But the thing is that they did not pick up that language and start using it. Like, they knew that that language was for the stage and it was being used in a forum where it was appropriate, that it wasn't, and that it shouldn't be used for shock value and things like that, because we would talk about it. And we talked about concepts and ideas that were talked about, racism and you know, ageism and, you know, the idea of freedom of religion and freedom of choice and gender identity and all of those things are subjects that are talked about very often in slam. And so the girls got really exposed to that, and they really got exposed to all these great poets who came in all different sizes, shapes, colors, and identities. And I think that has fared very well for them, that they had that exposure, because they're a lot more tolerant,
right,
than they might otherwise be. So it's been a good thing.
There you go. And that is so true. You know, if you keep it locked up, you know, these ideas and thoughts, and then, you know, and that's not really a good thing. It's not really healthy. So, you know, you talk about it. You know, get it out there and talk about it with your kids, and that way they'll understand it better, and there won't be shock, and they won't be using it for shock value for others. So, yeah, you know.
Well, and we always used to read the same books. You know, when the girls were younger, I would read a lot of the books that they were reading. A lot of times I would read a good YA or middle grade book, and I would say, hey, you might like this. And the great thing about reading the same books is that we were able to talk about the books and the characters and the stories and what we liked and what we didn't like, and, you know, and it gave us a lot more fodder for discussion than, hey, how was your day at school?
Right. Yeah, I did the same thing with Max. You know, he was, and I think Alan's the same age, he's 19 now. And, you know, I wanted to know what these kids were reading. Why was Harry Potter such a big thing? So it's like I wanted to read it to find out, so that way, you know, we could talk about it, and then I'd be informed, and not, you know, some of your parents who got up in arms about it. It's like, well, did you read it? Well, no, I didn't read it,
right,
because it's trash. And I'm going like, how can you say that?
How do you know? Right. Well, it's like Ara went through a phase where she was very, she still really is a big fan of Ellen Hopkins. Ellen Hopkins writes very edgy YA. She writes about meth addiction and acting out sexually and things of that nature. But she does it in she does prose novels. So all of her novels are written in open verse or blank verse poetry. And Ara loved these books, and I needed to get to read these books. Well, of course, being with SCBWI, the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, and going to all these conferences, I actually got to meet Ellen. She's a great person, and a lot of what she writes is from personal experience with her daughter and some of the things, that the tribulations and trials that they've gone through. And so, you know, she's a great person. So I was able to get signed books for Aura and things like that. But Aura and I were able to talk about these things. Aura doesn't drink. She doesn't smoke. She doesn't do drugs. You know, she was not sexually promiscuous as a teenager, but she read these books. It gave her the opportunity to see and hear about these things and, in a way, almost experience them without having to go out and experience them, I think. And yeah. And they were, and in some ways, they're cautionary tales. So because they show the negative side of all this stuff, they don't go in there and romanticize these things. Ellen right. does not do that. She's very honest and truthful, and her novels are very honest and truthful. They're pretty amazing. She's quite well known, and she's got a lot of books out. And I highly recommend that people read them, if nothing else, just to experience the format that she writes in, because she was one of the first to really write in this format. And she does it really well. She's very good at it. But I think that Aura and I were able to have these chats and these talks about, you know, these characters in his book as if they were real people, which mm-hmm. in some cases they are. And so, yeah. Again, we're back to write what you know, write from experience. You know, how does that come out in your writing? And it really does. So, yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's so important to, and you know, I know some schools who probably would ban those books.
Yeah.
And I sure hate to see that. So many books are important in a development of a child's life. And some of the books that are banned are the ones that I would consider the most important to read.
I agree. Yep. Absolutely so we agree with that sentiment.
And if I remember right, it was Mr. Ray Bradbury who actually warned us about this. You know, banning books, burning books.
He did talk about that, yes. He wrote about that.
He warned us, you know, that once you start stifling society like that. So it is so important that, and here he wrote it in a fiction story without having to beat his idea over our heads.
Right, and that's the beauty, again, of fiction, and particularly, I think, science fiction and fantasy. It gives us the opportunity to put things at arm's length and view them from just outside that realm. It allows us to have a little bit better perspective because we can get a little bit of distance from who we are and what our issues are and how our society and how people behave. I think that is, again, that goes back to that whole discussion that we were having about resistant text and things like that.
Uh-huh.
I think science fiction and fantasy particularly lends itself to that because you can see where we're headed rather than, and it's less real. People have the ability to suspend disbelief and get involved in a story more readily when it's not as real to life. That's my opinion, and I'm sticking to it.
No, I totally agree with you. And the same thing goes with some television shows. I mean, it wasn't just Roddenberry, but, you know, we'll talk a little bit about Roddenberry.
Star Trek. I mean, in the 70s when Star Trek was out, they were looking at race and gender issues and things like that in a way that people found palatable.
Right. They could get away with it because they put it up in space.
Right, because it's science fiction.
It's just science fiction. And, you know, little did they know that they were the younger generation was being fed these ideas, these ideals.
Well, it goes all the way back to, you know, when Gulliver's Travels was written. It was actually a socio-political statement. And, you know, the big Endians and the little Endians and all of that stuff. All of the things that he wrote about were socio-political statements, but they were done in a way that it was at least palatable. And in some ways, in some cases, some of the things that were written back then it had to be done that way, because otherwise you could be imprisoned or beheaded because of speaking out against the way things were. So that's, I think, you know, part of where fiction became
Definitely
that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Shakespeare, you know, he could have been beheaded for sure, because he was definitely writing about social issues.
Well,
his own political agendas.
As far back as Edmund Spenser, too. I mean, you know, with the Fairy Queen, that, there was a lot of stuff going on in there that was hidden meanings within the story. So he could have been in some big trouble.
Right. Otherwise, you know.
He'd come right out and said those things. Yeah.
That's true. And yet, you know, the readers understood it. Yet, you know, if you would call the authorities, they said, well, this is just fiction.
Right.
You know, what's the deal here? Hey, fiction author, get away with everything.
We try.
Yeah, we try.
Don't
we try. Yeah. Yeah, we put some ideas out there that sometimes are quite outlandish. But, you know, we have fun with it. Sometimes I wonder, though, I know you're writing fantasy, but, you know, some of these authors who write, since you were in the military, perhaps you can, you know, tell us what you think about this. Some of these authors who write stories about espionage and some things that happen in Iran and Iraq situations, don't you think they get a little too close to reality and perhaps give too many secrets away?
Well, I guess it really depends on, you know, when they're publishing these things, you know, and what they're publishing. I mean, you talk about secrets. We really should, you know, do we really need to have that many secrets? And when is it okay to talk about this stuff? I mean, yes, we don't want to out somebody who's in the CIA. Of course we don't, because that would be dangerous to them. On the other hand, we need to know what's going on out there. So, and a lot of times it's from their own perspective. So, again, you have to, you know, it's like a jigsaw puzzle, and you're putting it together, and you put all the blue pieces in, and then you finally realize that all those blue pieces make an eye, you know, and you didn't know that when you saw the pieces. So sometimes you have to read a. That's why I try to read very broadly, mm-hmm. to get as many different perspectives as I can. And there are things I want to throw at the wall, and there are things that I don't agree with, but I think it's important to at least get some exposure to that whole variety. As far as, you know, what are they writing on the Iraq War? You know, I'm not, I wouldn't say that I've been reading a lot of that. You know, aside from things like stories of the war dogs and things like that, those are kind of where I've been concentrating. I don't read a lot of thrillers or espionage. I do read some, but, you know, there's, again, it's fiction. So I don't know how close they're cutting to the bone.
Yeah.
Because I'm not privy to that information. So I can't really judge.
I have some people who asked me that question once before, and I said, well, you know, it is fiction, but and we do give Americans, you know, publisher give an awful lot of leeway, I think, to fiction authors. But on the other hand, it also, as you say, it does inform us of potentials for some of these things that have happened. So it's interesting that, you know, truth is stranger than fiction sometimes.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And it does make for interesting fodder. So if it's kind of like going to college and you suddenly find out that, you know, we have the CIA and that there have been, you know, behind the scenes saving us on numerous occasions. And the Navy SEALs as well. So you find out this whole world that you didn't know was there.
Absolutely. And, you know, and yes, there's a danger there. It can be a slippery slope to have these organizations. But on the other hand, not having them is also dangerous as well. So that becomes a whole nother discussion.
Yeah, that's true. So we know kind of what you're working on now. So tell us how to get a hold of you if people want to know more other than the places that I've already sent them.
You sent them the website.
I sent them to Brookhave Media.
Brookhave Media. And I have my own website, www.sharonskinner.com. I have a Facebook page, so you can find me on Facebook. And I have a Twitter account at SharonSkinner56. So, and I tweet a lot of different things, a variety of things related to writing, grants, as well as fiction, things like that. And then I will be, for those who are local, my next big thing locally is that in September, I am the Mesa Library's local author for the month of September. So I'll be at the various libraries on Saturday afternoons. I'll be at a different library each Saturday during that month. I will be then, the next thing will be, I will be at Tuscon coming up in the fall. And so those are the kind of the things that are coming up.
Go ahead. I was just telling everyone know that TESCON is the second weekend of November.
Yes, second weekend of November. And I am facilitating a local writing conference on, it's October 12th this year, and that will be in Scottsdale. It's focused on children's writing, but when I say children, I mean from, you know, picture books all the way up through young adults. And it's an industry conference. So we have agents and editors and publishers who come in from New York and California and different places. We bring them in to do a whole day of craft and industry. So I've got that coming up.
That's awesome. And, you know, you told me about that, and I didn't even know they were doing that.
Yeah, I'm actually I've been involved in that organization for a number of years, and I've been doing that particular conference. Oh, my gosh, I've been facilitating that for about 6 years now. The last 2 years formally as the assistant regional advisor to the SCBWI Arizona region.
Wow. Well, you know, you just never know. You learn more about people as you get to know them and the different things
that's
that they
so
do.
True.
And that's what's cool about sitting down and talking to people like this, you know, in an atmosphere where we're just chatting, we're talking about some things that you do and all the different diverse things. Which really gives you a whole new dimension.
I'm a multifaceted individual, yes. There's a line in one of my poems that actually says, I've reinvented myself more times than Madonna. So,
I was thinking about that the other day, going like, how many times have I changed, you know?
Mm-hmm, yep.
And it's a never-ending thing, and it should be. So that's what it's all about.
Yep.
Two questions. Somebody asked me, any research that you need to write your books? How much research goes into those?
There's always research. It's interesting. The healer's legacy has this whole, because she's a healer, she has to know about the plants and the flora that, you know, that help to heal. And so I did a lot of research into herbs and plants. I dipped my toe in that water anyway when I was living up in the Northwest a little bit. So I did a lot of research into herbology, and then I took that research and in some cases I used the plants that existed. Some cases I actually renamed some of the plants that existed, and in some cases I made up my own based on what I had learned. So there's always things to learn. I had to find out, when I was first writing The Healer's Legacy, I needed to know how far a horse could travel in a day.
Yeah.
Without collapsing. How far you could walk in a day, depending on terrain, you know, a healthy person, you know, what kind of trees grow typically at what at what levels, you know, on a mountain, so that I could describe my forests and my mountains. And, you know, even though there might only be one or two lines about the environment, about the trees or whatever, I wanted it to be as real as possible. So there's always that. But I try not to let the research get in the way of the writing. So if I'm writing and I don't know what the trees look like, I will put a placeholder. Rather than go out and do the research right then and there, I'll generally put a placeholder, which I use three question marks so that when I can, I write in Word, so I can always do a search find on the three question marks and go back and go, oh, yeah, I need to go do this research. So I'll put placeholders.
Mm-hmm.
That way I can always go back and fill in after I've done the research.
Oh, yeah, question mark or put a line in there, knowing, yeah.
Whatever it is that you're going to do a search and find on. So there's always research. In fact, the book that is in the chiller right now, I did a lot of research on witchcraft and Wicca and things like that because there are some things that I really wanted to know to make more real in that, because it's an urban fantasy and it's got you know, witches and werewolves and things like that going on in it. So I really wanted to do some solid research on what is out there that, you know, and then modify it to suit my world. But that's the kind of thing that I do.
There you go. You know, that's a question that a lot of non-writers or writers who are trying to break into the business, they ask that question a lot about research. Because a lot of people think you just sit down and write the book, don't you? No. I mean,
well,
yes, we do, but then we go back and actually do research in order to make sure that the idea is solid.
Right.
Yeah.
Animal husbandry, weaving, what kind of materials that you would expect to have in a civilization that was pre-industrial, you know, depending on where your setting is, those kinds of things. Drawing maps, you know.
Yes.
Understanding what a town looks like, you know, even if it's like my urban fantasy, it takes place in a somewhat small town. I wanted to know what streets were there and how it was laid out and where the houses were and, you know, what it looked like, you know, and what the nearby environment looked like. So it's really important to me to make that as real as possible. So I draw my maps and I, you know, plan that out. I was on a panel recently with some really great writers, David Brin and Sam Sykes and Patrick Rothfuss. I was on a panel with them at the Tucson Festival of Books this year. And one of the things that Patrick Rothfuss is amazing at is his world building. And he basically said that he's the creepy guy down in the basement building this world. And he knows all of these things about his world. And then so that when he goes to write about it, and he writes about his characters, he already knows what the setting looks like. He already knows what the monetary system is. He already knows what kind of food and clothing they have because he's been sitting down in his basement building this world. And we don't get to see but a small part of that world, you know, in his books, even though his books are, you know, 1,000 pages long. We only get to see a small part of that world that he's built, but that's what gives it the real grounding that you get in his books.
Exactly, and that's one reason and that's what the difference between a good written book and a solid book, because you're really submersed in that story because they've done their homework.
Right.
And you have to do the homework. There's no way to get around it.
That's right. You have to do your homework, and you have to understand your characters, and you have to do your homework in your craft to make sure that the way that you're writing is understood. You know, I don't believe in formula writing, but there is structure to storytelling that is very helpful, and that, you know, if you don't follow it, you need to be breaking the rules for a reason. Otherwise, people won't stay with you.
Yeah, definitely. They'll notice. They'll notice those kind of things.
Right.
We are at the last 5 minutes, and I have a special question that I usually ask my special guests here on the show. And it really kind of funny because it's perfect for you.
Okay.
And you'll know why. It's now that you have successfully slain the dragon, how will you celebrate?
Oh my gosh, that's a great question. You know what? I celebrate with my readers every time I get to talk about my work. Every time I get to sit and talk with somebody about writing, about the books, about my characters, I, in a sense, am getting to celebrate the fact that this transmitter has a receiver. And that's the big thing for me. I happy dance a lot these days because I know people are picking up my books, they're getting involved in them, they're getting engaged, they're disliking characters, they're liking characters, you know, they want more. And so that's really, for me, it's an everyday happy feeling that I get to enjoy. And I get to do these things like this, go to the libraries. I'm going to get to go to the libraries every weekend in September and do that. I get to go on. At Comic-Con, I was a guest author this year, and that was just really so much fun for me, talking to people about the craft, talking with other authors about the craft and the writing and the characters and the books. I love doing it, so that's my celebration.
And that's such an awesome answer. And it goes, again, you so well with you and your type of stories that you write, so... I thought, yeah, this is great. I have to ask her. And, you know, the fun thing about the question is that everyone has a different answer.
Right. There's no wrong answer.
There's no wrong answer there at all. It has to do with their style. And you learn more about a person based on what they answer. So it's an interesting question. It was asked to me on a blog once, and I thought, that's a great question. I'm going to have to use that.
Yeah. It is a great question.
So with that, we are on the last few minutes, and thanks so much for coming on, because you know, you and I do things at different events, and yet we just never have had a chance to sit down and talk about anything.
It's true.
We're like two shifts of pass in the night, really. And
a lot, like at the post office today.
Yeah. That was weird. Let's tell everybody the story about that. I walk in and go, I'm like, okay, she looks familiar. She's got red hair. No, that can't be Sharon, can it? So I'm standing there, and you were getting a little exasperated, I think, about even having to be there. and then you kind of look to shy and say, oh, it is her. And so I looked and said, Sharon? So, you know, you never know. This is a post office we both don't usually go to, and here we are, you know, right behind each
yep.
other. So.
Too funny.
And that's, you know, it goes to show you that the world is not as big as we think it is.
No, it's not.
So thanks so much for coming on. And
thanks,
you know,
for having me. I enjoyed it.
This is a gift that keeps on giving, as I think you probably know. It's a gift because when somebody, even if they didn't listen to it live, it keeps on giving because it goes in archive mode. And I have people who go back for several years to listen to shows once they find this channel. So that's something that I like being able to do and hand off and being able to get you get Bob the obviously the embedded file, so that way you guys can share it. And thanks so much, because it's been in here, it's now dark now. It did rain. It did rain for a while.
Yeah, it rained here too.
Not anywhere near as much as we wanted to.
But at least it got wet a little bit. So
yeah, it did get wet a little bit, everyone. I know Arizona, it got wet a little bit. It didn't pour. It just, you know, kind of drizzled for a while. But hopefully it'll come down a little more later. So I'm just glad to be inside during it. So
yeah.
thanks so much, Sharon.
Thanks again, Patty. I've enjoyed it.
Bye-bye.
Have a good night.
Thanks. That was Sharon, and I just want to let everyone know about one more really fast Kickstarter for a friend of ours who's trying to get a movie done, and it's for Locker 13, and we wrote about it some time ago. Back in the very first issue of the WAD newspaper, we had talked a lot about Locker 13 and the location in which they were doing their shooting. and also some of the people that were in the movie. So take a look at it. I've included it in the bottom here of the chat area, and click on it and find out more about that Kickstarter. Again, every little bit helps, and they do give some credits. If you give them a little bit of money, they could definitely put you in the credits movie. Kind of fun. So with that, I'm going to see you guys on Thursday. We have another show coming up, but it'll be 5:30 p.m. Arizona time, Mountain time, and that'll be 3 hours difference. So thanks so much, and see you. As Patty Holstrand, this is K Radio signing out.